Thanks.
Let's chant the prayer verse again.
Om Apyayam Tumamangani Vak Pranas Chakshu Shrotramato Palamindriyani Chasarvani Sarvam Brahma Upanishadam Maham Brahma Nirakuryam Mama Brahma Nirakarot Anirakaranamastvanirakaraname astu Tadatmani nirate ya upanishat sudharmaste mai santu te mai santu Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
We'll chant verses 1 and 2. I want to say just a few more words about verse 1 before we go on. So repeat it for me.
Om Kene Shitam Patate Preshitam Manaha.
Om Kene Shitam Patate Preshitam Manaha.
Kena pranav pratamav praiti yuktaha.
Kena pranav pratamav praiti yuktaha.
Kene shitam vacham imam vadanti.
Kene shitam vacham imam vadanti.
Chakshushrotram ka udevo yunakti.
Chakshushrotram ka udevo yunakti.
Have you done that? Kristen, have you two done these verses? Sure, Tricia. Sure. The next one? You want to do them?
We only did the first one.
You want to do 2 and 3? Or not?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Shrotrasya shrotram manaso manoyad.
Shrotrasya shrotram manaso manoyad.
Vachoha vacham sa upranasya pranaha.
Vachoha vacham sa upranasya pranaha.
Chakshusha chakshuratimuchadiraha.
Chakshusha chakshuratimuchadiraha.
Pratyasmaloka damrita bhavanti.
Pratyasmaloka damrita bhavanti.
Let me work on these two, then we'll do the third one if we get to it. Easy. I never know. It would be nice if you did. Okay. To look at it like this, the student being a mukshu, having some adhikaritam, wanting to know the nature of the self, really, is approaching a guru. So this guru-sisha relationship, the sisha is approaching a guru, the teacher, with a question. Remember I said in the Upanishads, they are a dialogue, the guru-sisha dialogue. Sometimes it's more than one student. Usually it's a dialogue between the teacher and student. And that's In the Katha Upanishad, it's a dialogue between Lord Yama and Nachiketas, who's a young boy. That's a beautiful Upanishad. Maybe we can do that later. but so, it's understood in the Upanishad that the mumukshu, or the jignyasu, one who desires liberation, the desiderata, the mumukshu, that reduplication is there, mumukshu, or jignyasu, that's nya, reduplicates and becomes jignya, and then that su ending, jignyasu. Nya means to know, so the one who desires to know. Much, from a mukshu, that much is the one who wants to be free, the freedom, or the one to be free, like that, who wants, not who wants to be free, that makes it the desiderative. So the one who is free or released, it has meanings like this. So mumuk, the root is much. So in the reduplicative, it becomes mumukshu, the one who wants that liberation or wants that freedom. Jignyasu, the one who wants to gain knowledge. So actually here, the mumukshu, the one who wants to be free, has to be converted in the teaching methodology into a jignyasu, the one who wants knowledge. So to say that you want to be free, which means that you want knowledge, that's a big jump there. Because what that means in the making of that jump is that you have to recognize that the self is already free, you just don't know that. That there's something that needs to be known, and that knowledge itself is liberation. So it starts with the viveka vairagya, where you realize that everything in the creation is time-bound, and so it cannot, by any stretch of the imagination, give you what you really seek as a human being, what all beings seek, actually, which is to be whole and complete, to be free. So I want that freedom. There must be, Bhagavan must have some answer for that, so you throw your hands up to Bhagavan and pray that a teacher will come and teach you. But you don't know what the teacher is really going to teach you. I mean, an Indian would have more access to the Vedas to know that there's some Brahman that needs to be realized. So there's a conversion that has to take place between this desire to be free to the recognition that really it's the desire to know myself, which is already free, right? So it's no longer that there's something for me to do to become free. There is something for me to know to recognize myself as already being free, have always been free. So there's this conversion here between the mumukshu and the jignyasu, the one who desires freedom, the one who desires knowledge, because knowledge itself is the freedom, you know? As opposed to, this is a very important distinction, because maybe we think that, well, if I do all of these rituals, all of these upasanas, which there are many of, in the first portion of the Vedas, they will do many, many rituals and upasanas and do lots of charities, follow Dharma very strictly, do lots of japa, repetition of mantras and all of these things in order to acquire enough punya in order to go to Swargaloka. And for that, that is their moksha. And so then they would study the Vedas, learn all of the chants, learn all of the prayers and all of these things, and do them, not for a jignyasu really, would be doing them, all of those things that they used to do to gain Swargaloka or to gain better births. Now they'll do all of the same rituals, everything, for Antakarna Shuddhi, in order to gain punya. You know, so that I can have the qualities necessary to gain this knowledge. So, in the first part of the Vedas, we learn how to do all of these things, and you're doing them all for a purpose. You're doing that so that you can get a particular gain. So say you're a samsari, and you are held within the Vedas, and so you're doing these particular pujas and rituals, all of these things that can take up your whole life, actually, so that you will accrue enough punya so you can go to Swargaloka, okay? And that is your moksha. You even think of it, if you're a samsari who is a karmanishta, devoted to karma, means rituals, in order to gain a particular end, the highest end that you can gain is Swargaloka, which you will think is moksha. That is me going to a place and getting a better upadhi, and having all my desires fulfilled as they come up, and living for a really long time until the creation goes into its unmanifest condition, and then I have to come back again as a jiva, accrue more punya, that type of thing, okay? But here, you learn how to do the upasanas, you learn how to do the chants, you learn how to do the japa, you have a whole list of sadhanas that you learn how to do, and then you have to do them. What if you learn all of those sadhanas, you learn how to do the japa, the meditation, the pranayama, everything, and your whole day is set. But you have to do it. Here, in terms of the Vedanta, the Upanishad, there is nothing to do. There is something to know. Like if we say something to do, it would be, well, you have to drive the car or take a long walk to get to where the class is, you know. You have to be able to get off from work. All of these things, you have to do lots of things to get to the class so that you can expose your mind to knowledge, so that the ajnanam, the ignorance that is causing you to take yourself to be a jiva, to be this body, mind, sense organs, can be removed, so that you can recognize that this me, this very simple me that has always been me, is actually absolutely free. Now, what's there to do in that? And what's there to do? Well, you have to get your body and your sense organs and an awake mind, you know, in contact with the teaching. It's very, very simple, actually. It all has to line up. Your mind has to use your sense organs in order to receive that teaching. But what are you doing in terms of receiving the teaching? You're lining everything up so that when that teaching comes, it will be received in the mind. It's very simple. I think of it just in terms of like your eyes. I am looking at that, kind of that beautiful mandala type piece on the wall. Now, what am I doing? Well, I came here, I sat down, you know, and then I raised my head up, I opened my eyes. My mind is using my eyes and not daydreaming. Okay, so now I'm set. Now what happens? Is that knowledge takes place. I'm actually not doing anything at all except lining it up, setting it up. There's nothing to do. I can't have my eyes open and look at the object and not see it if my eyes are working. Like, I'm going to look at this object and I'm not going to see it until I want to. There's no choice. There's no choice in that. And so here, if the whole vision of the Upanishads really is Advaita, that yours, the self that you are, is really the non-dual me of the entire creation. And the entire creation has no being apart from the self. Now, what do I have to do to know that? There's nothing, I don't have to create that. You know, we're talking about knowledge. I don't have to create myself, or I don't have to go out and find myself somewhere. I don't have to do something, operation on the creation to be able to understand that it's mitya. There's really is nothing to do. Now, I just have to have a mind that is available to that teaching when the teaching is being utilized as a pramana, as a means of knowledge. Okay, so nothing at all to do, and yet there is quite a bit to do. Just in reference to what we call upaya nishta, gaining the antakarana shuddhi, the availability, the shraddha, all of these types of things, we grow into that. We come with a certain amount of adhikarikvam, right? Of qualifiedness. Means my mind is enough available for this teaching to make use of it or even want to sit there and listen to it. So there's a certain amount of qualifications that are already there that allows my mind at the time of teaching to be open and available to that the functioning of that pramana. Now say that's there, the pramana is functioning, and the self is there, the world is there, the universe is there, everything you need is there. And so now what's the task? The task is to be available to that teaching. Just like, what's the task for me to be able to see that beautiful wall hanging? What's my task? There's really no task once I'm sitting here and my eyes are, you know, in the vicinity of the wall hanging. There's no task. The pramana has to be available. And my mind has to be available to that pramana. So that's why we say, you know, I mean, what am I going to do for that, even for that availability? How am I going to gain the shraddha to even make my mind want to be available? Or even the desire? for moksha. Even that desire is considered all Ishwara Anugraha. Ishwara Anugraha is all Ishwara's grace. And so then what is Ishwara's grace? Is he picking favorites, a little grace for you, none for you? You can have some, you know, now. It's not about favoritism, so what is it about? You say it's about dharma, it's about punya, it's about crores and crores and crores of punya. How did you accrue all of that punya, all of these lifetimes? How did you get so much punya, you know, to even want to gain this knowledge and then to have a teacher and have this pramana flowing? What an incredible amount of punya. What did you do? It's just life crores and crores and crores of lifetimes, according to Viveka Chidamani, where there is a commitment to dharma. Because in the commitment to dharma, the raga dveshas, the likes and dislikes that you have, become subsidiary, they become secondary. And so they don't have the pull, the hold on your antakarana, on your mind, as dharma. Dharma has the pull. Dharma first. And then all of these desires second. And so all of my behavior, all of my activities, all of my reactions go through the filter of dharma. And all of the incoming desires come through the filter, comes this way through the filter of dharma. That gives my mind, it's, and what is dharma really? How we say, like, what is, how do I worship Ishwara? How do I operationalize that? You know, how do I do it? Say I want to worship Ishwara and have everything that I do be a puja to Ishwara. Well, be committed to dharma. Dharma is Ishwara. Yeah. If the commitment to dharma is the commitment to Ishwara. So that kind of helps one to understand, how do I really accrue all of this punya, or how do I really have a relationship to Ishwara? You have a relationship to dharma. Because Ishwara is dharma. The whole, like the whole manifestation of the creation is dharma. All the laws, all of the laws, the psychological laws, the laws of raga dvesha, the, all of the laws, the, all of the also the anartas, all of those unpleasant things that come our way. That's all part of the total picture. So that commitment to dharma protects. We say dharma protects. And dharma allows the mind to have the shanti, the depth of shanti that is necessary for this knowledge to land. The knowledge has to land in the mind, right? The teaching coming through your sense organs. Teaching's coming through your sense organs, landing in your mind. And so what kind of a mind is it that it's landing in? Is it, it can be a mind, it can be a highly distracted mind, you know? And so then you hear it like in a sentence, it's got 10 words in the sentence. And you're able to get 2 or 3 of those words. Or there's a paragraph that has 10 sentences in the paragraph, all flowing out with nonstop, but 10 sentences in the paragraph. How many of those sentences do you hear? If you have some relative degree of shanti and mumukshutvam, the mumukshutvam itself brings about shanti, because that means you have a desire for gaining the knowledge that's happening. That mumukshutvam, or that being a jignasu, that jignasa, that desire for knowledge, that is there. You have a desire. And so that helps the mind be present. But that it's that mind that is present, that mumukshu mind, is something that gives you, even though we're not perfect dharmis, and we have our own raga dveshas because of ajnanam, I mean, obviously, we're still looking out in the world to become happy. But if that mumukshutvam is there, just like any desire which is with its object of desire, there is a shanti, a concentration, a being present. You know, what if you have no interest? What if you're not a mumukshu and you have no interest at all in this, and you'd much rather be taking a walk in the forest or going into town or something like that? Then you have to do your time. When you have to do your time because you're stuck in the class, you have to do your time and just wait for it to be over. And so you, in that condition, which I've been in that condition many times in school, not as the teacher, but as the student, certainly. The teacher has an advantage because the one who's teaching is just going on and on and on, so they're present to whatever they're saying. The student, though, you know, that's a hard thing. to be present to something you're not interested in. To have your mind present for that, that's almost impossible. So the mumukshutvam, at least in when you're with the teaching, gives the mind enough shanti and samadhanam, that presence to be there with it, so that this knowledge can just come in and do its job. You know? So here in the Upanishad, what you have to take for granted is that the person who is coming to the teacher is a mumukshu, is a jignyasu, held within the Vedic tradition. And so this jignyasu, the one who desires to know, held within the Vedic tradition, knows quite a bit. They know that there is a Brahman that needs to be known, and that I'm supposed to be Brahman. I have no idea how that's possible, but the Upanishads, which I have Shraddha in, the Vedas, which I have Shraddha in, you know, say that there is Brahman, and that Brahman is the Jagat Karana, the creation, the one from whom this whole creation comes. This is common knowledge, even in the first and second part of the Vedas, and the Ramayana, and the Mahabharata. All of these things are known, but it's what we call apatita jnanam. Apatita jnanam is that I've heard all of these things. I've read about all of these things. I've heard stories about all of these things. In the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, there's so many stories. There's so much Vedanta. That's why you should never bother with an abridged version, honestly. If the abridged version is just the action story. But all of the real stories are not even in there. The stories where all the Vedanta is, all of the Dharma, all of the wisdom, that Ramayana and Mahabharata is full of it. And so you think that, so now, in an Upanishad, or in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, there's always the dialogue, is always there, and the dialogue is between the guru, the one who has this knowledge, who knows how to wield it as a pramana, because the Upanishad is a pramana. That's what the Upanishad is. It's a pramana. And so the guru or the rishi in the Upanishad is somebody who is wielding that pramana and teaching you about it, and teaching you about Dharma and all of these things. And who is the sisha? The sisha isn't just somebody who's dropping in because somebody told you there's some interesting guru up there in the mountains. Not in an Upanishad. That would be more common day. There's this really, really amazing guru, and he's up in the Himalayas, and you can, you know, go up there and have some darshan from him. You know, it's kind of a popular thing to do. But that's not an Upanishad. An Upanishad means this student, you know, has some exposure, you know, somehow. And for a Westerner, you have to think back. It's really wonderful to think about it. Think, what was your exposure? How did that take place? That you even knew there was something like liberation or moksha, that there even was such a thing. What was your exposure, and how did that strike you? You know, it's really fun to share those stories, because everybody has a story. You know, just by chance, I think I was like 13, and my girlfriend and her mom used to take us all kinds of places. So she took us to Sausalito, and we went to this famous little bookstore. And just by Bhagawan's grace, I pulled two books off the shelf. I didn't even know why I pulled those books off the shelf. One was Lao Tzu, you know, with the Tao, and the other one was a condensed version of the Upanishads, just in English, just a little thin book. And I just opened them up, and it just totally blew my mind. Because there it was, something. I don't know why. It's all samskaras, but there it was. That was my very first exposure. So you think of just think about it, you know. What was it? What was said? What occurred to you? Or did you have a dream, you know? Or did some vritti come through for no reason, you know, that made you know that's what I want, that's what I need to know? That's because you're picking up the thread from your last life, as the Bhagavad Gita would say. In your last life, maybe you got this knowledge at old age, you weren't able to fulfill it, you died, picked up the thread. It's a beautiful verses in, I think, the end of chapter 6. So it's nice for you to recognize your own mumukshutvam and how that happened. So here, this question is the question of somebody within the tradition being taught by a rishi who is ready for this knowledge. And so just with that little intro, if you remember what this I'll call jignasu, what this adhikari, what the student says, he asks this question. He says, This my mind, the mind itself, it is directed for what reason I don't know, but the mind is always directed towards some one given object or another. Or this thought arises, then this thought arises. Why does it even arise? You know? It arises for a reason and it goes towards something. So I understand that my mind is definitely directed. But who's directing it? By whom? Who is the one that this mind that is so directed, who's the one directing it? So kena ishitam, by whose will, by whose desire, by whose presence, going into the commentary, by whose presence does this mind, you know, as though being directed, fall upon certain experiences, reaches its object? Because of whom? Who's doing it? By whom is that done? Because you can't say, well, the mind, it's because of the mind. The mind is, the directed mind is directed by the mind. Okay? This mind is directed. Who's directing it? The mind is directed. Okay, but the mind is directed. So is it a mind that is directing the directed mind? Or is the mind just directed? Who's directing it? You know? Because it is directed. So by whose desire, you know, or by whose will, or by whose presence? If we say by whose presence is it directed, then you can say by whose presence? Well, it could be like, for instance, as an analogy, it could be like the presence of a king. A king is often used as an example for this, where the king is sitting there in his kingdom. And all of these people are running around doing all of these things because of the presence of the king. All of these jobs are necessary to do for the sake of the king. Right? And so even though the king's not doing anything, by his presence alone, all of these things are done. So maybe it's like that. Or maybe you can think of, it's like an analogy that we can use, you know, like a magnet. A magnet doesn't do anything except be a magnet. But being a magnet, all of the iron filings are pulled toward it. Not because it's doing anything, but just because it is what it is. And by its own swarupa, by its own nature, the magnet draws everything toward it. Is it like that, you know? Or is there somebody outside somewhere doing something? What is it? Who is this one? What is the presence? Otherwise, if you say, well, the mind is directing the mind, then is there a mind that is directing the directed mind? So again, you get into all kinds of infinite regress there. So there has to be someone, something other than the mind, because of whom the mind is directed. You know, it's kind of like the person who lives in a house, you know. All of these things, the house is so nicely cleaned and built up, and you have everything in there you need, right? Because it's your house. So you have the things that you need, and it was built for you. And so the whole house was done for you. So here, whatever I'm doing, all that I'm doing, all that I'm seeing, all that I'm perceiving, that is done for me. All that I'm thinking, all that I'm emoting, all that I'm feeling, all of my reactions, all of my perceptions, all of my studies, all of the accumulation of my knowledge. Who is that for? It's for me, right? Who are my sense organs for? They're for me, right? Who are my organs of action for? They're for me. No, your hands are just for your hands. Your hands are for your hands. Your feet are for your feet. Your mind is for your mind. No, it's not. All of them are for me. because of me, all of these things are done. Now we start making sense. It makes sense, but we have to see what that actually means. All of these things, all of these experiences, all of the luminosity, you know, that my sense organs enjoy, all of this, it is for me. But who is that me? That's what it amounts to. Who is that me for which all of these parts are functioning? I'm like the king or the queen or the one because of whom all of these are acting. So who is that one? And then he goes, that directs the mind, by whom is the prana? The prana itself, the vital force. For whom do the pranas function? So if they just take the five pranas, for whom do those pranas function? For whom is the breath? For whom is this body kept alive? By whom? Who, you know, all of these people are speaking. They're all speaking. So because of whom, by whose desire, are all these words coming out? Who's talking? You can say, no, really, who is talking? Who is it that wants to talk here? For whom is all of this talking taking place? You know? I guess the speech just wants to talk. The speech just wants to talk, so it's babbling away. No. I am saying something. So it's all in honor of me that this speech is happening, right? Because I desire to speak, right? But who's that one? So that's what he's asking. It's a good question. Then he says, check, and what about the ears and the eyes and my five sense organs? All of them, you know, are able to gain knowledge. They're all conscious. They're gaining knowledge. They're all shining. They're devas. It means they're self-effulgent. They're brimming with consciousness. Because wherever I direct them, those things are known. Every wherever it falls. So who is that one that really, because of whom all of these experiences are? And so that's the question. And the teacher knows exactly what he's asking. Because that was the teacher's question also, in one form or another. That's what we need to know. It's just in a Vedic way, it is the who am I question. Who is this person that has all of these faculties? All of them. The mind also is a faculty. It's an instrument. We have all of these instruments. You've got your five organs of action. You've got your five sense organs. You've got the whole vital force. You have the unconscious. You have so many ways that the mind deals, you know, with all of the data that's coming in. It's an incredible thing. You have memory. You have a buddhi, you have the manas, you have this equipment that you utilize. It's not utilizing itself, you know, just doing its own thing, you know. Even if it was doing its own thing, who's doing its own thing? So here in this verse, second verse 2, repeat after me, as I break the sandhi. Shrotrasya shrotram.
Shrotrasya shrotram. Manasaha.
Manaha.
Manaha.
Yet.
Yet.
Vachaha.
Vachaha.
Avacham.
Avacham.
Saha.
Saha.
U.
U.
Pranasya.
Pranasya.
Pranaha.
Pranaha.
Chakshushaha.
Chakshushaha.
Chakshuhu.
Chakshuhu.
Atimucha.
Atimucha.
Diraha.
Diraha.
Pretya,
pretya,
asmat,
asmat,
lokat,
lokat,
amritaha,
amritaha,
bhavanti,
bhavanti.
Just a word on these sindhis. Most of them probably you're starting to get familiar with. Like, just look at the first line. Shrotrasya, no sindhi. Shrotram, that's the ma. Taking the makara, taking an anuswara, so shrotram. Manasaha, so many times you see that visarga going to, this is for people who have some, starting to study sandhi, you see that visarga going to o, so manasaha goes to mano, manaso. Manaha goes to mano. So visarga, the two dots, often go to an O. So manasaha becomes manaso, manaha becomes mano. Second line, vachaha becomes vacho. So that what that means is that when you're reading and you see a word ending in O, chances are quite great that's a visarga. It can be other things too, but it's probably a visarga. Right? So vachaha, vacho, then ha, vacham. Sa is always going to be saha. It's an unusual Sundays that are in play there, that more often than with any other, that that's when or a visarga most often drops with sa. So sa is means he. Saha. Then pranasya, pranaha, nothing there. Then look at this other one. Chakshushaha, chakshushas. That sha, before a cha or cha, it becomes sha. So that shakara, that letter sha, is often, can often be, not necessarily, but can often be when it's conjoined with a palatal letter, it'll be visarga. Chakshushaha. And then chakshur, sometimes the visarga can become ar, refa, chakshuhu. So chakshushaha, chakshuhu, atimucha, diraha. I'm just telling you these things, just point them out once in a while so that you can just get very familiar with and happy, not in having any consternation over these continual changes in the letters, you know. There's actually very beautiful, wonderful rules that you can learn to kind of put this in a very organized way, but sometimes it's nice just to point them out so when we're chanting you see them. The next line is interesting too. Pretya, and then asmat. There the dental ta is followed by la, and it will take the lakata. So asmalokat. Asmat becomes asmalokat. It takes the lakata. So pretya asmat lokat. That the ta becomes da because of soft consonant or vowel. Amritaha bhavanti. So these are just, you know, there's probably not that many, maybe 30 or less sundi rules that are very, when they're organized properly for you to learn, they're very sensible and pleasing. If you like math or anything like that, you know, if you like mathematics, it's very pleasing because of the level of beautiful organization. Okay, so here, this is the teacher answering. His first answer. And I want you to notice something. In this answer, just like in the question, the student doesn't say, who is the Atma? What is Brahman? You know, he doesn't say that. He doesn't label. He says, who is the one by whose present or desired by whom or willed by whom? All you get there is the by whom. Who is that? You know? There's no, who is this Atman that they talk about in the Upanishads? You know? Who is the Atman that I'm supposed to be? No. He's actually very grounded in the experience that he is having. He has the experience of his mind, he has the experience of his sense organs, he has the experience of his speech, he has the experience of his prana. And he realizes all of these things are doing a lot of things, and I'm identified with all of them. I'm the prana, I'm the body, I'm the body, mind, sense organs. But who is the one that this house is for? You know. So his question is very grounded in his experience. And so the teacher's answer is also beautifully grounded. So what the teacher says is, okay, you asked who is the ear. Shrotrasya shrotram. Right? Who is that one because of whom the ear hears? So what does it say exactly? It says, by whom does the mind, by, desired by whom does the mind, is the mind directed? Who is that deva united with whom that the eyes see and the ears hear? You know, who, because of whom, united with whom, does the prana function? Is there the prana? Right? But here, instead of saying the Atma is such and such, he says, that one yet, who is the ear of the ear, shrotrasya shrotram, and who is manaso manaha, manasaha manaha, the one who is the that which yet, that which is the ear of the ear, that which is the mind of the mind, vachaha havacham, that indeed which is the speech of the speech, vachaha is in the sixth case, the one who is the speech of the speech, sahau. He is the one, that one. That one who is the, he, the one, that one, saha, there's that, who is the prana of the prana, pranasya pranaha. Then he says, chakshushaha chakshuhu, the one who is the eye of the eye. Dhiraha atimucha dhiraha. Those wise people, those ones who have knowledge, atimucha, they are freed. I have to unfold this for you, but just to see in just the tightness of the verse. Dhiraha, atimucha dhiraha, those ones who have knowledge, they atimucha, having been freed, amritaha bhavanti, they become immortal. Those dhirahas, having become free, having been freed, they become bhavanti amritaha. Free of death. Mrita means death. Amrita, free of death. You can say immortal. They become free of death. Pretya asmat lokat. Having left. Now here, when we say, there's a term here, pretya asmat lokat, which means having died and left this loka, this world. But loka also has a very particular meaning also of just that which is experienced is loka. Because from loop, so that which is experienced is called a loka. So here it says, asmat, this loka. So there, then when we take it in this context, it means from this body, mind, sense organs, from the ears, from the speech, from the eyes, from the prana, from the mind, having been freed from that, atimucha, having been freed from that, then pretya asma, I'll get to that minute. Pretya asmat lokat amritaha bhavanti. There's two things here. The atimucha means having been freed, released here itself. Having been released here itself. From what? So as we'll see as I unfold this, but just to tell you for now. Having been released from that ahankara that has taken me to be the mind, the ears, the speech. Speech stands for all the karmendriyas, all of the organs of action. So having taken myself to be this body, this mind, this sense organs, what I say, to take myself to be this body, mind, sense organs, that we call this karya karana sangata. Sangata means this collection of capacities that I have. The capacities are my prana, my sense organs, my organs of action, the different types of thoughts I have. All of the whole sukshma sharira that is embodied in this physical body, having taken myself to be all of that, all of this, you know, I am then identified with this body, mind, sense organs. In what form? The ahankara. The ahankara, because of ajnanam, I take myself to be this. Ahankara means I am this body. I don't have to say it, I know it. You know, so I don't have to walk around and there's her ahankara there. She just said, I'm this body. You don't have to say it. You just are that until you know that you're not. You don't have to say, you know, I'm thinking, oh, she thinks she's thinking. No, you are thinking, right? You are thinking until you recognize that those thinking and all of those things are mithya. You have to recognize that, or that's who you are. In fact, there's a beautiful verse in the Panchadashi. That really addresses this kind of tongue in cheek, that for an ajnani, the ahankara is just the aham, you know, it's just the aham. That's who I am. I am walking to the store. I am reading a book. That is, there's no satya mitya. There's nobody else doing it. I am reading the book. I am walking to the store. I am tired and going to sleep. that I is a total identification with this body without a second thought. No. For somebody who has knowledge, that is not bound by that ajnanam anymore, then for when the jnani will talk in exactly the same way. I'm going to the store, I'm reading this great book, I'm tired, I'm going to go to sleep. They both say it's exactly the same thing, you know. But the meaning is quite different, right? Because the jnani is not going to use abnormal language. You see, he actually writes this in two or three verses. So the jnani will say, I'm going to the store. The ajnani says, I'm going to the store. Oh, so the jnani knows that they're going to the store. Just like I know I'm going to the store, so we're both going to the store. So what is their knowledge, really? Because both of us are going to the store. Both of us are reading a book. We're both reading it. Okay? I'm reading a book, you're reading a book. That's fine. So there's nothing really to know. What's there to know then? I'm thinking, you're thinking. I'm tired, you're tired. There's a lot to know there. What has to be known is that for one, I am reading the book is satyam. That is the reality. Satyam means what it actually is. To them, is satyam. This is the reality. For the jnani, the exact same experience is mithya. That's a huge difference. That is night and day. One is mithya, one is satyam. For the jnani, anything that can be objectified, for something even to be mithya, there has to be a subject-object differentiation. I have to have viveka. You can't have mithya. You don't even know what it means without that viveka. The viveka is what? The differentiation between the ear of the ear and the mind of the mind. Something else. A different recognition of myself. A different recognition of who I am. We'll see in depth what this means, but I want to get this clear first. There's a different recognition. I recognize myself as the adhishtana, the one that the ear depends upon, the one that the mind, for consciousness, for existence. I am the one that the ear depends upon. I am the one that the eyes depend upon. I am the one that the mind depends upon. I'm the one that the karmendriyas depend upon. Without me, there is no existence, there is no consciousness. So I know that as a jnani, I know that. I know that that one is satyam. That is myself and that is satyam. Satyam means that would actually exist. For the ajnani, there really is no satyam. Not in the way we define it. The way we define satyam is that which is not subject to time. That which is not changed in past, present, remains unchanged in past, present, and future. That which is never negated in past, present, and future. That which is timeless, actually. That is satyam. Now, how could an ajnani, somebody that doesn't have self-knowledge, no viveka is there, what would satyam mean for them? They don't have that definition. They have no recognition of what that would even mean. So for an ajnani, the satyam is the waking state, basically. It's the Ishwar Srishti, this vyavahara, this empirical reality that we're all sharing, you know. And then what would be more equivalent to mithya, though not equivalent, but more equivalent, would be something like the dream state, you know? Because the dream depends upon me, but it has no real reality, you know? They wouldn't call it mithya because they don't know the meaning of the word. I'm just trying to tell you that there, even the definition for an ajnani as satyam, the reality is just going to be the shared reality that we all experience, you know? And then the pratibhasika, that's the imaginal reality, would be something which just belongs to me. It's subjective. You know, it's my imagination. It's my fantasy. You know, it depends upon me for its knownness and its being. So that's similar to mithya, that they won't have that word. That's the reality of a samsari, of somebody who, until they have knowledge. You know? That's not at all the reality for ajnani, because the viveka jnanam, because of the viveka, And so what that means is, if you start, as we'll see in this verse, the ear of the ear, the mind of the mind, all of this type of language means that there's something that these upadis, these conditioning adjuncts, totally depend upon for their being, for their consciousness. They have no substance of their own. They don't have consciousness from their own standpoint. No. And so say, how will I even know that? There has to be some sort of a differentiation. So say that differentiation is there and I've recognized my own self. I know who I am, with the Atma, what my being is. I recognize that. And I recognize the relationship of this mithya, of this body, of the body to myself, which is kind of like the relationship between the pot and the clay. So I have clay pot. What's the relationship between the pot and the clay? Well, the clay is what's actually there and the pot totally depends upon it. So what is the relationship of all of these upadis, all of these conditioning adjuncts with me? You know? It's the relationship of that which itself depends upon me for its being, but I don't depend upon it. So that aparoksha jnanam is there for jnani. So now that jnani that has this knowledge, they say, I'm going to the store. What do they mean? They're accepting this vyavahara, this empirical reality in which this body is, and this objective reality in which this mind, the mind and your imagination, just accepting that. It has an empirical reality. So from within Ishwara, this body, mind, sense organs is a functioning entity that is going to the store. But what is the reality? Is that, does that mean that now I think that the Atma, that my being is going to the store? Or do I think that my body, which enjoys, as mithya, and enjoys completely myself, as do all bodies in the whole creation enjoy myself, that this body, because I have a self, because it depends upon myself, so it has existence and it has consciousness, that this body is going to the store? So I would say for the jnani, you say, I'm going to the store. The ajnani says, I'm going to the store. But when I say, I'm going to the store, the I is mithya, the going is mithya, the store is mithya, and the body is mithya. And the one who wants to go to the store is mithya, right? Brahman isn't thinking, let her go to the store. Not happening at all. So... So this type of language we use because we have an upadi, like everybody else. I have this body, you have this body, you have this body. We all have minds, we all have sense organs, and this is how we talk with this empirical reality. And so the jnani will talk exactly like the ajnani, but the difference is one takes this to be their own version of satyam, of what actually is, not knowing anything else, and the other, you know, takes it to be mithya, having totally dependence on something else for its being, recognizing that viveka having been there, this word mithya becomes meaningful. So we talk like a normal person. That's one verse. The second verse about this, differentiating the jnani from the ajnani. The other is interesting, and I think helpful, because I kind of learned the hard way on this when I came back from India, you know, with this golden jewel that everybody should have. Right? That's how I came back from India. So what this verse says is, well, what about Brahman? You know, if they're only just talking like everybody else, then what about Brahman? What about this knowledge? You know, what about the fact that I am Brahman? You know, what about the fact that this whole universe is mithya? They're just talking like an ajnani. No. They talk all of this. When they're teaching. In the class, when they're teaching. That's when this talk is there. Not otherwise. You know? Like, say we think, gee, everybody should know this. And I really was, of course, I was really young. That's the only thing I can say. To make a... For this embarrassing, you know, way of being. I thought everybody will be so happy to know this. You know? And so I just wanted to tell everybody, you know, especially all my good friends and everyone, Of course they want to know. They'll be ecstatic, you know. And then I was going to a graduate school, doing some Sanskrit and stuff there. And one of the teachers didn't seem to understand. He's talking some Vedanta kind of stuff. And he was more of a Buddhist. He had no clue, you know. And to me that was, oh my God. He's destroying all these people. He's destroying them in the sense that he has the Vedanta completely wrong. And so they're getting an idea of Vedanta that nobody would ever want to study in their life. And so my hand goes up. So embarrassing. So naive. It's like a convert, you know. So I was like a convert that wanted everybody to know. But you know how it is for me now and for people who have been with knowledge for their own knowledge for some time, I think is what is much more normal, is that you really never even bring it up. I never ever talk about Vedanta unless there's a student there who wants to know. It's not table talk. And it's only really meant for mumukshus. This knowledge is meant for mumukshus. If a person is not a mumukshu, this knowledge is not of much interest. It's not what they're interested in. And so that doesn't bother me at all. I don't think everybody has to be interested in Vedanta. Not everybody has to be a mumukshu. Not at all. They'll be a mumukshu when they're a mumukshu. That's up to them. Just like you became a mumukshu when you became a mumukshu, and I became a mumukshu when I became a mumukshu. You've only been here for infinite lives. It took a long enough. You know. So what on earth difference does it make? It makes no difference at all. And it's the promise of the Upanishads also that when a person becomes a mumukshu, or really desirous of this knowledge, they will meet their teacher. That's how it works. When a person is ready for this knowledge, then they'll meet their teacher. And maybe they'll meet teachers along the way, but at the right time they'll meet that teacher who really works for them and can... and for whom this knowledge, you know, comes out in a certain way that is meaningful. You know, that you're ready and willing and to listen to. That's all kind of taken care of. You don't have to worry about that. You know, it's not your responsibility. Yeah. I think that's very nice to recognize that it's not your responsibility at all. You know. That if a person's a mumukshu, they will get exactly what they need. Just like when you need other things too, according to your prarabdha and the needs, you get what you need. We all get what we need. So that frees you a lot from worrying about all of the crazy things that are out there. There's a lot of crazy things out there. But, you know, that's what that person is doing at this time. For whatever reason, you know, and what you're doing at this time is for a very good reason, because you're a mumukshu, and if you weren't, you simply wouldn't be here. It doesn't, you know, unless it's just like I have a lot of students at CIS. Why are they even in that class? You know, they come from all different spiritual disciplines. They're not really mumukshus, but as I see it in their different interests, it's kind of like dropping a little seed that they happen to need at this time, you know, because they're in the class. They're in the class, and there's a lot of Vedanta in the class. There's a lot of Buddhism in the class, too. They're getting what they need, that's all. Doesn't mean that they're a mumukshu, but they're getting certain seeds that are planted that make a huge difference. So it isn't our problem at all, you know. And it doesn't, I notice over the years also, it really doesn't matter to me. I don't require my friends to be jnanis. I have really good friends who aren't jnanis and don't even really know about Vedanta. They know I teach Vedanta, that's all. But I get a lot from they have so many things to offer for me. I get so much from them and they get so much from me. It's just Vedanta is not one of the things they get. And Vedanta, that guru-bhai relationship, is not one of the things I get from them. But you don't need to get that. That's why somebody was asking me the other day in the satsang, you know, about should I marry a jnani? I don't think it makes any difference at all, really. I mean, maybe that can be a boon, but they could be a really cranky person, really cranky jnani, you know? I'd rather be with a really loving ajnani myself, you know, who let me have a lot of freedom to do the things that I want to do. So it's really not, it's not about having a married jnani. It's not having to have jnani friends. You know, it's beautiful and wonderful that we have a sangha, but I'm sure you all have friends that you love and spend time with who have nothing to do with this knowledge and don't have any mumukshutvam at all. It doesn't make any difference. And you don't have to walk around saying, you know, the body's going to go to the store now. my pranas are tired, I've got to lay down. The body's got to lay down. Shut the eyes have to shut, you know, so it can get adequate rest. You know? Knowledge rests so lightly. It rests so lightly. It only rises up because it's you. And it rises up as in terms of words when you're teaching. Otherwise, you're not walking around teaching. You know, you're teaching because there's a student there. That's why you're teaching. Otherwise, you're not walking around thinking that everybody wants you to be their teacher. They all have to know this, you know. They don't have to know it at all. They'll think you're just a madcap. You're trying to teach all these people something that they could care less about, you know. I told you about the story of my mom who, when I got home from India, and she asked me what I did there and how it was, and I gave her a big Vedanta lecture that was that big Vedanta lecture. I mean, I was sharing, you know, really sharing. And she said, "Oh, honey, I don't have those kind of problems." Mm-hmm. She didn't want me to go on anymore. She wanted to do what I was doing there, you know, where I was staying, who I was with, where I went to see.
Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.